Hey there, I'm Dax Nielsen, and you're listening to Live from My Drum Room with John DeChristopher. Enjoy.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me today on Live from My Drum Room. My guest today is Dax Nielsen. Dax is a multi-instrumentalist, best known as the drummer for Cheap Trick. Cheap Trick, of course, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees, legendary band. Dax has been the drummer since 2010. Going on 14 years. He's one of those drummers that, you know, plays other instruments, and it's bad enough that he plays drums so great, but then he plays guitar, he plays piano. I hate those guys, but I love this guy. So please welcome Dax Nielsen.
Hello, John.
All right. Good to see you, buddy. thanks for joining me today. I know you've had a little bit of a busy day so far. So thanks for being here.
I wouldn't miss it for the world, my friend.
Thanks,
Brad. Craziest thing is it's December 1st, and
I know.
The Elf on the Shelf came out, and advent calendars, and so my kids were in my room at 4:45 this morning, pitch black, going, Daddy, Daddy, Mommy, Mommy.
Oh, man. How old are your kids, Dax?
They're 6 and 7, two little boys, but I got like 4.5 hours of sleep last night.
But that's all right.
Like rock and roll life on the road, you know, you don't sleep much.
Yeah, exactly. Man, those are such great ages too. I have two grown kids, and I have two grandchildren that are 8 and 5. So similar ages, and the whole Elf on the Shelf thing is just so fun and so great. Yeah, that's awesome, man. That's great. Well,
but it's so good to be.
I'm so happy to have you, and I just want to say again. It was such a pleasure to hang with you at PASIC. I'd only really met you one time before at a NAMM show, and our friend Jim Catalano, I think it was the year he left. J-Cat, yeah, the year he was leaving Ludwig, and I saw you at the Ludwig booth, and I, of course, knew who you were, and I wanted to meet you and got a great picture with you. But, man, hearing you play at PASIC was such a thrill. I heard you play at the jam session one of the nights there. And you sounded so great just going up there cold, sitting down with the band. And then I got to see a little bit of your clinic. I had to leave about halfway through, but killed it. So congratulations.
Thank you. It was my first PASIC ever, believe it or not. I've been to NAMM a bunch of times. But my good friend Mark Powers got me involved, and Eric Hughes. Yeah. They both been trying to get me to come to PASIC, and it finally worked out. And I got my first drum clinic under my belt, which was so nerve-wracking. You know, I'm a band drummer, so I like to play behind other people with a group. And so to be up there by myself going like, hey, everybody, watch me play drums. And, here's, you know, it was great, but it was something foreign to me. And I'm so glad that I got the opportunity, and I got to hang out with you and so many other great people in the industry and other drummers. And it was just... I think I'll be back to PASIC pretty often, even if I'm not playing, because it's a great hang. I think that... The drum community has a different vibe than guitars or bass. Like, we all hang out, and like, nobody's trying to steal each other's gigs. We're like trying to help each other find gigs and just pick each other's brains. And it's just so fun.
Couldn't agree more, Dax. Yeah. I love PASIC. I always love going when I was working in the industry, and I've only gone a few times since I've left. But it's going like for you. And I think I'd be somewhat in the same way, that going there just as a fan, you know, as a civilian, as it were, it's so much more fun, because you can just float from clinic to clinic, from room to room, and really soak it in and enjoy it. It's great.
Yeah, I loved it. I think, like you said, you had to leave halfway through because there's obligations for people. And I went to a couple clinics and had to leave, and I felt awful because, like, I know as the person up on stage, you can see people walking out, and you're like, ooh, do I suck? Like, what's going on here? But no, there's so much going on that I can't stay this whole time. And so thanks for watching what you could watch.
Absolutely. Well, I only left because I had to catch a flight home. I swear I'd have stuck around. I really dug it. And you being a band guy is right up my alley, because I love, you know, drummers that are accompanists that can go up there and just play music. And I mean, there's some great, you know, technical clinicians, soloists, and that's always great to watch. But like hearing Matt Chamberlain play and hearing you play, and that's kind of where I come from too. So
yeah, it was great. I got to watch Matt Chamberlain, Matt Cameron, Glenn Coggi, you know, Nick Collins.
Right.
Yeah, Nick was great. Yeah. I mean, he's 22 years old and he's up there as nervous as I am, but he, you know, I'm 43, so I've got 21 years of figuring myself out, you know, so it was just fun to like, cause mine wasn't until I think Saturday. Yeah. So I got to see a bunch of Friday clinics and go, okay, people walk out, even if it's Matt Chamberlain, people walk out, you know, it's like, okay, he's playing too long or he's talking too much. Like, you know, I kind of got a quick little, some Cliff's notes of what I tried to do. So it was cool.
That was very smart of you to do that. That was really smart to observe that. And so that when it was your time, and like you said, if somebody was leaving, you didn't get vibed by it and go, oh man, do I suck?
It's not personal.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I don't know if you remember, I saw you just before you went on. I think you started a few minutes late too, for whatever reason, like maybe whoever was in the room before you, I think it was like after 12 when you were getting ready to go on. Right. And I saw you standing there and I could tell you were a little nervous. And I think I said, you know, good luck. How you feeling? You're like, I'm a little nervous. Of course you were, man. I mean, I don't know.
I think that's good for any gig. I mean, if you're up there and it's just day, it's another day, another dollar, another gig. If you're not a little nervous, a little excited, then I think that you're doing the wrong thing. Cause I mean, I get to go up here and play in front of all these people, even though I'm not comfortable doing it. Like, okay, I'm excited. I'm nervous doesn't necessarily mean I'm scared. It's like you're pumped up and your heart's racing a bit, which is good, I think.
Well, it was great. And congratulations on getting the first one under your belt now. And it's, it'll get easier. I'm glad that we're, you know, showing a lot of love to PAS and PASIC, which for everybody watching, if you don't know what PASIC is, it's Percussive Arts Society International Convention. And PAS is the Percussive Arts Society. And there's a great guy named Joshua Simons who runs the whole show, and Mark Powers, as you mentioned, who's the drum set guy. And they've just got it dialed in so well now too. I mean, the show was perfect. I thought from every vantage point. Yeah. Really great. So, and speaking of J-Cat, he's watching right now, Jim Catalano.
Hey, Jim Catalano, the man, the myth, the legend,
the man. So man, I learned some stuff too that I didn't know. I think at lunch that day, we had a great lunch, Dax, myself, Keo Stroud and Matt Chamberlain, which was great. Four drummers walk into a restaurant and, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
Tapping our forks and knives on the table the whole time.
Yeah. No. It's funny. I get this photo here and, I want to just show you this. This is classic Matt Chamberlain. It's kind of like, get the feeling that Matt was kind of not wanting to be around us. You know, he's like, there's all of us, you know, bro hugging. Right. And there's Matt kind of going, I don't know about you guys. You guys look a little shady.
He's great. It was such a fun lunch. And I mean, he's super personable and we were telling all kinds of fun stories, you know, amongst ourselves. It was great.
Yeah, it really was. It was fun. And the cool connection of that you used to play with Brandi Carlile and he's now pretty much that's his regular gig now, I guess, amongst other things that he does. He does so much.
But I mean, he was the drummer on the albums. So when I was playing live, I was playing Matt's parts, you know, a lot of the time. So, yeah, she's huge now. So I think, you know, when I was playing with Brandi, we're either opening for people or we were playing for, you know, 500 to 1,000 people, which is no small feat, but now she's selling out four nights at Madison Square Garden. It's a little bit bigger now. And you know, so I think he's the perfect drummer for that gig. It's, you know, so many of those songs he played on in the studio. So when you can get a studio drummer to actually go on tour, that's also a big feat.
Yeah. And you played with her, obviously it was before joining Cheap Trick. It was before like 2010. So kind of in her early, as she was sort of.
Yeah, like it was on the second album tour, the album called The Story that Matt played on. So I think it was 2008 and 9, a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, we were telling this story. I don't know if it's not common knowledge, but Matt and I were chatting. We both did an album for Brandi. I played six songs and he played six and They all got thrown in the trash. Never saw the light of day. I'm like, damn, that would have been great.
That would have been great. Well, you know, stuff like that seems to find the light of day eventually, right? I mean, it's possible that.
Yeah, I mean, it's on my computer. I would never post it out of respect and out of whatnot, but I don't think it will never get released. But they re-recorded with a different producer. That was, I think that was the main problem. Yeah. And then they got Victor in Drizzo, which is such a great guy, such a great drummer.
Yeah.
He's on so many albums as well. So, you know, I don't take it as a personal slight, but I sure would have liked to have my credits on a Brandi Carlile album with Matt Chamberlain. So
sure. Yeah. The other thing too, that was a surprise, which I maybe you mentioned it at lunch that day or just in conversation, but, you played with Dick Dale.
Yeah.
And that was like, yeah. Yeah. Continue. Sorry.
The King of the Surf Guitar. Yeah. I played with him. He was really my first gig. When I moved to Los Angeles in 2004, my mentor and my best friend, Todd Trent, who is a legend in the industry. He's a civilian now, as you said.
Yeah.
But he was the A&R guy for Ludwig Drums for so many years, probably 30 years. I called Todd, as I always do when I'm doing anything new or, you know, if I'm not sure how to navigate something in the industry. And I said, what do I do? And he said, get a job. When you get to LA, get a job, because you're not, no offense, but you're not going to be number one top dog right away. Not that I ever would have been that, but so I got a job for a while and, at a place called Center Staging, which is basically a backline rental company similar to SIR or Soundcheck in Nashville. And, through that, I met a lot of great people, but, yeah, my first real gig when I got to LA was with Mr. Dick Dale.
That's awesome.
It was a life-changing experience because, you know, he's 68 at the time. He's passed away now, but
yeah,
you know, he was big before the Beatles were big, you know.
Yeah.
He had all this great success in the 60s. And then I always compare Poison and Nirvana. You know, Poison was huge and then Nirvana came out and killed it. So Dick Dale, the Beatles were his Nirvana. Like the Beatles came out and suddenly nobody cared about surf music anymore, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But
then Pulp Fiction came out and his song was the big, huge song at the very beginning, the opening scene. And so he got a career resurgence with that movie. And so I got to tour with him and, you know, he knew all the tricks. He was one of those kind of Chuck Berry types that, if my neck goes up, that means speed up. If my neck goes down, slow down. If I shake my butt, that meant something, you know, like there was just cues.
Yeah.
And so it was like one of those hands-on, you know, real time, no set list, follow the leader, follow the band leader kind of gigs. And it was, you know, it was such a great learning experience. I got to do that for a couple of years. Maybe
awesome,
3 months.
Dax. Yeah. Man, talk about like incredible training, you know, and I'm so floored by that just because, you know, I'm from that generation that, you know, is well aware of his legendary status. And I got this picture. I just wanted to show you this. I knew I had it somewhere. He, I think, you know, he's from Quincy, Massachusetts.
Quincy.
Yeah. Which is the home of the original, Zildjian factory. And so in 1994, I wasn't sure of the date, but he signed it. He called the Zildjian factory, got put through to me and was on tour and wanted to come and take a tour of the factory with his band. He pulled up in his tour bus and I don't know who his drummer was at the time. And I probably like laid a cymbal on his drummer, but he just wanted to come in and hang. And I'm like, I think he was maybe even surprised that I knew who he was or something. I just remember talking to him on the phone and I said, yeah, man, well, like you'll be here in an hour. Sure. We'll make it happen. And, and he was a character, as you certainly know. I remember he was definitely, you know, he gave me this photo, signed this photo to John C. at the ranch, Dick Dale.
Yeah.
And I just remember going, and I know I took a photo with him, but I couldn't find that, but, anyway,
well,
I just
looked closely at that photo. He was one of those rare guitar players that he played upside down and left-handed.
Yeah.
So if you look, like the big strings are at the bottom versus that. So he took a right-handed guitar and just flipped it over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And played it like that. And there's a few other guitar players that do that, but it's pretty rare. There's Doyle Bramall Jr.
Yes.
And my buddy Matt Beck, who plays for Matchbox 20. There's like, I can only name off the top of my head, like two guys that know how to do that. It's really, really quite strange.
That is wild. It makes you think.
I mean, Dick Dale, he had one, you know, such a long career that, of course, he had numerous drummers, but 94 might have been Prairie Prince.
It wasn't Prairie. I believe he brought his drummer, and I would have been like going like this if it was Prairie Prince.
Could have been. Was it Dusty Watson? The great Dusty Watson?
That sounds highly likely.
Could have been. He's a great guy. And I owe my career to Dusty, honestly.
Yeah. Wow.
So I had a band in Rockford, Illinois that I had for about 7 years. I was in a band the whole time. And then this guy, Bill Dolan, long story short, called me up and said, hey, he's a great guitar player. He said, hey, I have this gig opening up for this guy, Dick Dale. He probably didn't say this guy. He said, I have this gig opening for Dick Dale and I need a backing band. It was just a 3-piece. So he hired me and the bass player in my band to open up for Dick Dale. And I think this is a good lesson for any young drummers out there or old drummers. I got to play the gig and I stayed and watched Dick Dale. And after the show, I ended up talking to Dick's bass player and drummer, Sam and Dusty. And we're talking for a while. And I said, I think I'm going to move out to LA soon. And they're like, oh, cool. We live out there. Here's our number. And I didn't move out for at least a year after that. I got a job at U.S. Bank. I became a banker and a teller so I could make enough money to move to L.A. And when I got to L.A., I called Dusty and he goes, holy shit, you actually called. Like, I kept your number. I told you. And he goes, so don't ever lose anybody's number and, that kind of thing. And,
yeah.
So when he was going out with Dick, Dusty was kind of pretty popular around town as well. So he would say, hey, you want to sub in for me, so-and-so the gig. So he handed me like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 gigs and I did a good job every time. So he ended up at some point leaving Dick Dale for the Super Suckers. And so he called me and said, hey, every gig I've put you on, you've nailed it. Right. I get phone calls and say, hey, thanks for the recommendation. So he handed me Dick Dale because I kept his number and it's just one of those things that I followed up on something,
Yeah. And you did a great job too. Certainly don't leave that out that he didn't get a phone call from the guy going, why'd you send this guy over, man? He wasn't happening. Yeah. Obviously you nailed it. And I just think the story's so cool, Dax, because your dad is Rick Nielsen, just the whole connection to Dick Dale. And I wondered what your dad thought of you playing. Was Dick Dale an influence on your dad when he was growing up? And
yeah, I mean, I think definitely to this day, when he introduces me to people, he goes, yeah, he's our drummer, but he used to play for Dick Dale. He learned all the bad things from Dick, not from me, that kind of stuff. I've told him some of the stories that I can't repeat, but Dick was a wild man and an interesting cat. So there's some stories that I've told my dad. He goes, oh, I'm so proud of you. that's the real deal thing on the road.
Oh man, that's awesome. I'd expect nothing less, but I just thought when I heard that, I felt man, imagine being you're the son of this legendary guitar player and you're playing with this legendary, it's got to make your dad so proud, and just that whole, the fact that I assume that your dad was influenced by Dick Dale. So it's all a cool full circle or connection,
That was definitely, I think, a proud moment for him, Rick, my dad, he's old school. He's born in 1948. So, the emotional thing was never quite there, like most men back then. I'm proud of you, son. But other people would tell me that he was gushing about what I was doing out in L.A., in my own career kind of thing. I understand that it's a different generation. Now I'm hugging my kids and petting their head and telling them I love them. But, it was a different thing. So
sure. Yep.
I think definitely he was proud and still is proud of the things I did pre Cheap Trick.
Yeah, that's great, man. And I think it's a great, I don't know your dad. I've met him a couple of times, but I certainly don't know him. But I just think it's a great thing that he had you go out there and do it on your own. You know what I mean? You went out and paid your dues playing with some big bands. Besides, I know you had your own band before, Dick Dale and Brandy Carlile, your original band. And so you paid your dues in all these different ways along the way and proved you could cut the gig with Cheap Trick, which is
I think there's obviously the family aspect of things, why I got the gig, but also I think they knew they could rely on me because I had been touring. I had been a professional for, you know, over a decade or two by the time I got hired, you know?
Absolutely. And I was just going to say too, I mean, the fact that you made that commitment of like what every serious musician, not every, but many serious musicians do, which is you move to LA because certainly at that time when you moved out there in the early 2000s, that was still where you wanted to be. You could argue Nashville too, but I still say LA in terms of like networking and the sort of different types of gigs that are out there. And, you know, you weren't waiting around for your dad maybe to help you out and find a gig for you somewhere, you know, like it was.
That would have been a long wait. I definitely was not sitting around. I say this all the time. I never, ever expected to be playing for Cheap Trick. It was never on my radar at all, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was out there doing my own thing. And at some point, I think, you know, you have to either want to be a struggling musician, singer, songwriter, band guy, or you eventually say, I want to be a working musician, you know, and that's kind of what I put all my effort into my band.
Yeah.
After 7 years, it ran its course. And I just said, I'm not done. You know, I'm only 24 at the time. Like, I'm going to go to LA and just work for people. Like, low risk, low reward, kind of like a mutual fund. You know, I'm never going to be wealthy because I didn't write the songs. I'm not in the band, but I can plug along and have a 35 year career, hopefully, you know, and retire as I paid all my bills, you know, raised a couple of kids by playing music for a living.
Yeah.
So that's pretty great.
That's more than pretty great, buddy. I'll tell you, like, you had the maturity at 24 to like know a lot of shit that people much older as we know people much older that don't figure that stuff out, you know,
right.
and that's great that you went out there with a completely open mind to just being a working musician. It wasn't like, you know, if I'm not in a band that's signed and multi-platinum in a year, then, you know, yeah, you just got to let it all. You know what I was just going to say, Dax, is I can't believe I never met you at Center Staging because I used to go in there all the time.
Well, I mean, I was definitely, I'm definitely under the radar. I've always stayed under the radar. Like my brother and I, the band I was in for years was me and my brother, and we always avoided the Cheap Trick thing. We always avoided, because we thought we were a good band. And I think that's kind of still what I do is like, I don't expect any phone calls because my dad's Rick or, you know, because I'm associated with Cheap Trick. Like, we tried to make it on our own. It sure doesn't help if they can open a door for us. But, you know, I just think I went to Center Stage and I literally polished poles. That was my job. I sat there with a rag and a thing of spray and cleaned drum stands and, you know, like tuned other people's drums. And I was never like, hey, my dad's famous. You know, like, first of all, I didn't want people to know that. Cause why are you working here? But why did you have a gig? You know, but I think it's that Midwestern, just blue collar Cheap Trick, you know, still plays 100 shows a year anywhere and everywhere. And just, you know, it's what they do. There was never like the pompous, or like, you know, I'm too good for this kind of thing. Like, no, go get a job. Like Todd Trent said, you're going to need to pay your rent. So drumming probably won't afford you that for a while. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, you know, growing up with mentors like that, or just older people playing for older people that have seen it all, they kind of steer you away, hopefully, from the things that you could, the traps you could fall into, or the attitudes that you could unfortunately find yourself thinking, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well said. And, you know, and someone made the comparison like to, it's the same sort of mindset that I think of like Cheap Trick having, which is just this sort of working man band. You know, I know there's been like high points, low points, like any band has, and through it all, they just keep going. You keep going. You know, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2016, which that sure is pretty sweet. And
yeah, that was cool.
And like you say, you play 100 shows a year. I mean, the band will always have venues to play and a following with the catalog that you have. So it's a great situation.
It's been wonderful. I mean, I give them so much credit for just sticking it out. Cause, you know, it's like a marriage or being in a band, whatever you want to say. You have your ups and downs, that's for sure. You know, no career except for maybe Dave Grohl, has just been like consistently just up and up and up and up. You know, everybody
that
has,
bastard.
You know, yeah, I know, what a guy. I love him to death. What a career, and I wouldn't wish anything.
Yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say? I'm so happy for him. He doesn't need me to say I'm happy for him, but I mean, there's only a handful, Phil Collins and Dave Grohl, and name a couple more drummers that became more famous for being a frontman. It's just,
yeah, I know.
But
I know.
He never stops. He's like, same thing. He's born in Ohio, you know, he's Midwestern. Just, I got to keep working. I can't sit still.
Yeah. And you can tell he really digs what he does, and, yeah. And he's, you know, he does good things too. You know, he really is. He's like a guy that's trying to fix shit and do good things. And, can only wish him well and wish him continued success.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's got that. I think he's got the success part down.
Yeah.
I think he could retire today and still pay his mortgage.
He'd be all right. Yeah. I think he'd be all right. Exactly. Man, I so much cool stuff to talk about here. I know I'm going to get to in a minute. I know next year, 2024, you talked about this at lunch that day, that it's the 50th anniversary of the band. But I wanted to ask you, so you joined the band in 2010, so coming up on 14 years.
Yeah.
And I know you've recorded some songs with the band since you've been there. But just a general question, I think I'm curious to know, and I think others, drummers watching, would want to know, like, there's some great iconic drum parts that, you know, the great Bunny Carlos played on those records. And do you approach those songs like being somewhat faithful to the way like Bun recorded them? Do you, you know, I'm sure you give it your own little, you know, personality, but just curious how you approach some of those songs, some of those sort of iconic songs.
Yeah, I definitely do. I try to pay homage, and I mean, he's one of the greats of all time. And I think those parts that he recorded were the right parts to play.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like, I'm not going to go out there and try to change that by any means. You know, Ain't That a Shame, the Live at Budokan drum solo at the beginning. I start out these days, I do my own thing for 16 bars, and then I note for note try to mimic that. Oh. That's what people know. You know, any drummer that comes to the show goes, oh, he didn't play the part. The part, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's so cool.
You know, and like in the song Surrender, there's those great snare fills. And like, if I didn't do those, if I'm up doing some paradiddles or whatever on the toms, people are like, ah, he doesn't know what he's doing. You know, he screwed up the song. So, no, I think, you know, with stuff like that, those parts are so great and so correct that I try to do it. But I've always kind of said that all of us, every drummer out there, we have different length arms. We have different size hands. We have different length legs, you know, all that stuff. So no two drummers can play exactly, you know, hypothetically can play alike, you know. So I try to do my best in my body to do, you know, his parts correctly and the feel correctly, the swing thing, you know, like kind of swing bandy, you know, kind of shuffly, straight. You know, there's all kinds of descriptors I could use for his playing that it's what made him and what made the band's sound what it was. Cause you know, so yeah, I tried to initially, when I first got the gig 14 years ago, I tried to just note for note do it. And then eventually, you know, you become yourself a bit doing those parts versus like trying to go out and just mimic. Do it the same way every single time. Eventually, like, okay, I'm going to spread out here, I might do a ride here instead of a hi-hat or what, you know, the little things, but no, the sound is the sound, and I try to keep it as close to that as I can, for sure.
That's great, Dax. That's great. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't had a chance to see you with the band, and I was just curious, and I'm hoping that next time you come through town, I'll get to see you. And I just think that's great. I commend you for that. You know, I know when Dean Castronovo first took over playing in Journey, I don't know if you know Dean, I remember him saying,
yeah,
and he's a huge fan of Steve Smith. Like they're really good friends. And I remember him saying, and he played everything literally note for note from the records. And he said, they're the most perfect drum parts. Why would I change anything? And I thought that was so cool. You know, he's such a monster drummer, but he just like you said, played, you know, homage to Steve. So like you're doing.
I think, you know, you have to put your ego aside because you're, you know, you're not the guy that created the part. So why, you know, who are you to say that it should be different, you know, especially for the audience? I'd say 98% of an audience is not a musician. They would not know the difference. But
yeah,
when a guy like you comes to my show and I play something, you go, oh, that was weird. That's not how I remember that, you know? So I don't know. I think you do it for yourself to a certain extent, but I think you really play a show for the audience, you know? And
yeah,
when you're in the studio, it's for yourself. You create a part that you think is great and, or the right part. And, but you know, playing live, you know, if you went and saw the Eagles and the solo in Hotel California was just ad-libbed and different, you'd be like, oh, that's the hell I came. That's the iconic guitar solo, you know?
Right. So. Yeah, exactly. And you know, you're right about the audience too, like 98% aren't musicians or drummers, but it's interesting. I'll bet you notice this too, that when you play those parts or, you know, play the songs, people do, I'll bet they do react to the fact that you're playing, like, especially Ain't That a Shame, that, you know, some of those little things that Bunny played in the beginning are just so, you know, it's so friggin' cool. And that,
yeah.
I'm sure they go, wow, it sounds just like the record, you know? So
I don't get a ton of air drummers, but when I do, I notice that, you know, they're playing the part, and if I do something different, and I look and I notice they're playing the album part, and I'm like, ah, shit. Maybe I know that part, but I've been doing it this way for the last 2 years, like, kind of thing. You know, like, oh, well, you win some, you lose some.
Yeah, exactly. So you started, I'm guessing you started playing pretty young, right? I mean, music was in the house. You grew up with a house full of musicians. So how old, do you remember roughly how old you were when you started playing?
Drums was about 12. I mean, I had like tinkered, you know, as any 6-year-old, if there's a drum set, you're going to sit down and play. But when I was 12, that was like, okay, I want to be a drummer. But my parents, thankfully, they put me into piano lessons when I was in kindergarten. And I took them until I graduated high school. So I took 13 years of piano.
Wow.
So that's, I mean, I always say knowing piano, you can, left and right hand, scales, theory, tempo, dynamics. I mean, if you can play the piano, I taught myself drums. I've had literally, I don't know, 10 lessons in my life. It probably shows, but
you know,
I taught myself that, and I taught myself guitar, and I taught myself, do you remember Jeff Healy? He was the blind guitar player.
Of course. Yeah.
He was in Roadhouse and the Chicken Wire. I taught myself guitar on my lap like that, like, cause I played piano. So I taught myself chords like this versus,
wow,
you know, that, and eventually you go, okay, this isn't working from what I'm trying to do. So I took piano for a long time. And I really feel like that if you know piano, you can learn any other instrument.
Yeah.
But, 12 years old, drums was one of those. That's when I think I said it in my clinic. I was always just a shy kid. And so I could play guitar and I could play piano and whatever. I just never wanted to be up front. And my dad was a guitar player and my brother is a guitar player. So I just, you know, we don't need another guitar player in the family, but neither of them could play drums. So I've played in a band with my brother and I played in a band with my dad as a drummer. So it just kind of worked out that way.
Yeah. Do you play much piano at home when you're off the road?
I play all the time.
You do? Yeah, that's great. Actually, and you probably write
this,
music.
This box it. Right here.
Yeah.
It's a Roland. I'm getting my kids an electric piano for Christmas.
Oh, nice.
Costco, everybody. It's $500 at Costco. It's hidden underneath my Audimute blankets right there.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
Shout out to Mitch at Audimute. I don't know if you know his brand. It's some sound acoustical treatments. It's the greatest. And, you know, he's done a bunch of my friends now, but Carter McLean was the first, and then Sammy Marandino, and I was the third. He did my studio in the Midwest. And his business is booming now, and so many great drummers and guitar players and anybody that wants a good sounding room. Go to
Audimute. I'm gonna get, if I can get his deets, I'd like to reach out.
It's unbelievable the stuff he can do. I mean, it's all sound like I said, acoustical treatment material, but he can make it look like brick or fine wood or ceramic or cement. So whatever you want your room to look like, look like he can make it, but it's okay. Also sound, you know, he'll kill me. Acoustical treatment. That's what
oh man. Can he make me play better and taller?
Yes. It also helps. Yeah. It comes with the package.
All right. Cool. Cool. No, that's awesome that you started on piano that young. That's, I didn't realize it. I thought for whatever reason, I thought you started on drums and then took up piano and guitar. And, but that makes a lot more sense that you had that.
I think a lot of us drummers have seen this kind of thing happen too, that there's a million guitar players. There's a thousand bass players, and there's usually two or three drummers in the neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So people are always looking for a drummer because, you know, everybody can starts out on guitar or whatever. Right.
By the way, we got a bunch of folks watching on the Cheap Trick fan page. So
nice.
I want to give them a shout out. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. And on my regular page as well. This is great. Really good turnout here.
Thanks for showing up, everybody, to hear us blather on about whatnot.
No, about you, man, about you. And so you guys are probably done touring for this year, for 2023.
We are. Typically, I mean, not. It's pretty unusual that we'd be done all of, like, we're off basically all of November and December, but because next year is the 50th anniversary, I think management said, go home. You're going to be on the road a lot next year. And
yeah,
so
that's great.
There's always a chance I could get a phone call right now saying, hey, there's a private gig in Florida tomorrow. Like, but it's not looking like that. So
yeah, that's cool.
It's been nice that, you know, with little kids and a wife to come actually be, I go to bed at the same time every night and typically wake up at the same time every morning, which is unheard of on the road.
Yeah, that's, yep. There's something to be said for that, you know, that consistency. And like, you know, your kids being the ages that they are too, it's got to be so great to be, I know you love playing and love being on the road, but
right.
It's so great to be home with them at that age too, you know, at their ages. So.
Yeah, I finally last year or this year, I missed a birthday for the first time. That was hard. But I mean, when you're six, you don't remember your sixth birthday. It's the parent that remembers it.
And yeah. So, you know, yeah.
It's fine. When that kind of stuff happens, you're like, ah, I can't believe I missed that. And I missed my son, Ivor, riding his bike for the first time without training wheels. You know, that little stuff stings a bit, but I get to play, you know, rock drums in front of a lot of people.
That's
instead.
Right.
That's all good.
No, I for what it's worth, I used to travel a ton in my job, and
right.
And I definitely missed some birthdays. And my son, who's now 36, I remember like talking to him about that, and he was like, "Dad, give it a rest." Like, you know, he had no recollection of me missing any birthdays. So
right.
you're absolutely right. You know, you don't remember your sixth birthday, but you as the parent remember missing, you know, the birth. So
it's all about the time you spend with them when you are home that matters.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's great. Is there anything you can share about what you have in mind for next, what's going to happen? Is there, or like surprises, or is it just lots of shows, lots of touring?
All of the above. It's still kind of being sussed out, but I know we're going to Australia for like 5 weeks in February and March. We're doing a bunch of festival dates and then some headlining dates as well.
All right.
And as far as anything else, I don't know anything for a fact. So I can't, even if I did know it, I can't say it until they release it on the website or on the tour dates. But yeah, I think there's going to be some fun stuff for the fans, you know, and then obviously a lot of touring. We're trying to hit as many countries as we can, being as the 50th, you know. So hopefully, I know we're doing Australia. Hopefully we can hit UK, Europe, maybe a little South America, hopefully Japan, where, you know, the Cheap Trick's big in Japan, as they say, you know.
Well, no doubt about that.
Yeah, I think hopefully record another album at some point within the year. We're always working on new music, and everybody in the band writes music. So right now we're just compiling everything and kind of, which is how it's been the last, you know, I can't speak for the band, but the last four albums that I've been a part of, everybody comes up with ideas and just kind of shares it in the cloud, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I'm going
to
play,
find some time to do that. And
yeah, that's great.
I don't know.
I'm going to play a track in a couple of minutes too. And I was just going to, something I wanted to ask you earlier. I'm just curious, like what it must have been like for you to, when you became aware of like who your dad was and the band that he played in. And I'm guessing you had a pretty, it sounds like you had a pretty grounded, pretty normal life for the most part as a kid. And then you realized, shit, my dad's like a rock star in this really famous band that has this, you know, incredible history. And, you know, by the time you were a teenager, or even before that, they'd already made their mark, you know? And
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my parents have been married since 1969.
Wow.
So my mom had the desire to be a mother and my dad wanted to be a rock star or just a musician, if you will.
Yeah.
And they kind of both did that. So, you know, he was gone a lot on the road, but my mom, she always wanted to be a mother, you know, she wanted to have children. So it wasn't one of those things where, you know, she was at work all the time and we're like making our own lunch after school or, you know, I mean, no, like I was raised in a full home, you know,
yeah,
with loving parents and all that. So I'm very fortunate. I try to do that with my kids, but yeah, there was always people coming over to the house, you know, in Rockford, Illinois, there was a 6,000 to 8,000 seat, like basketball arena kind of thing that all the big bands would come through at one point. And back in the party days, they would always come over to Rick's house if he was in town. And so, yeah, I mean, at any age, I could look at, here's Guns N' Roses at the house. Here's Motley Crue at the house. Here's Poison. Here's Alice Cooper. Here's, you know, you name it. You know, there's no cell phones back then. So like the tour manager would just, what's your address? And, you know, the bus driver would drive up and they'd drink and do drugs. I assume. I can't, maybe they were drinking tea. I'm not sure, but you know, they'd party until 4 and 5 in the morning and then they'd head to the next city. So it's kind of like, it seems silly to say I didn't really know, or I didn't kind of think about it. But when your dad is that's kind of what, you know?
Yeah.
So it never seemed like, to this day, like, you know, I've befriended a lot of my idols, you know, by being in Cheap Trick and being surrounded in that world. I think if you're nervous talking to Matt Cameron at PASIC, you know, like he can feel it. But if you're like one of them, if you're one of him, you know, I think it's like, yeah, we can talk about normal things that we deal with or things that we do in this industry. And it's taken me a while, you know, to get to that point where like, okay, I can go say hi to Matt. He's a friend. Like he likes me. Like,
that's right.
Okay. Don't be nervous. He's just a normal dude that, you know, plays great drums in these giant bands, but he's also just, he's a dad. He's, you know, so I don't know. It's just one of those things. The more you can be around our industry and know those kind of people, it's, you don't get as starstruck. I got freaked out the other day. I was at Seth Meyers. I did the week with Seth Meyers as the house drummer.
Yeah. I'm going to have Eric on my show next week.
Oh, Eric Lederman. He's so great. Yeah.
He's a great guy.
Can't thank him enough for getting me on there. But at one point, Bobby Flay was there, and I'm a huge like foodie. I love to cook, and I watch two things on TV. I watch sports, and I watch the Food Network. That's it. I hate the news. I hate sitcoms and all that. But so here walks in Bobby Flay, and I just started like shaking. You know, it's like, he's my idol. That guy cooks great food, and he, you know, like, but you know, and then next to him is whoever, you know. Big rock star. Like, hey, man, what's up? Good to see you again. You know, that kind of thing. So
that's cool. Yeah.
You know, they always say like athletes want to be rock stars and rock stars want to be movie stars or whatever it is. You know, we kind of all want something that we're not familiar with.
Yeah. Bobby Flay he's a rock star in the food world, man, for sure. Yeah.
Him and like Mario Batali were like, they're the OG.
Yeah.
Second wave. There's always like, you know, the original, like the 1960s and 70s, Julia Childs and,
right,
Eugene Papin, those guys. But
man,
when it comes to like our generation of the Food Network, that was, you know, Bobby was right at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He had a great restaurant. I'll bet you have been to it. It's not there anymore, unfortunately. Bar American.
Bar American, yeah.
Yeah, we used to love to. We used to stay at the Hilton. When we go to New York, we stay at that Hilton right a block away, and that was always like the go-to restaurant. And we were so sad when he closed it, but. But man, he's got great restaurants all over the place, though.
I went to, last time I was in New York, not the last time, but I got to go to Mario Batali's Babbo.
Yeah.
Before that, Chloe, you know, unfortunately, he got canceled for maybe doing some inappropriate things with his employees. But
Yeah.
His food. The restaurant was unbelievable.
The Babbo that was in Boston, or the one, was there one in New York?
In New York City. Yeah.
There was, okay. Because there, mm-hmm. there was one in the Seaport in Boston, okay. closed as well. And yeah, Eataly is still there, though. In,
right. Yeah. In I think Boston, he's still there. I think they're all still there, but he had to step away.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so weird, Dax. We were just talking about this when we were in London, my wife and I, because we went to, across the street from our hotel was Pizzeria Osteria mm-hmm. Mozza.
Right.
And we were talking about Mario Batali and that whole situation. And but we won't go there now. It's we're talking about drums. And guess who's jumped in here to say hello? None other than the legendary Todd Trent himself.
Oh,
yeah.
My best bud, my mentor, legend. Yeah.
He is a great man. And I'm going to have Todd on here. We talked about this a while back, and I've got to circle back around on that. And as you say, a legend in the industry and one of the greatest guys ever.
Absolutely. I've learned more from Todd than pretty much anybody in my life. I've told him so, and he knows that. And we already talked about you, Todd, quite extensively. But yeah, I've always called him. And if I can't navigate something, Todd's always got the cement for me to put my feet on to figure out where I'm going.
That's great. That's great. And again, I'll just say for everybody watching, if you don't know who Todd is, he worked for Ludwig Drums for many, many years. Like you said, 20 or 30 years as artist relations, and was just the go-to guy for all the artists and did an amazing job. So, and also ran a music store in Orange County, you know, like at the same time. And how he ever did that, I don't know, but he did.
He's Superman. That's how.
He is Superman, yeah. I saw him leap a tall building one time in a single bound. Yep. So talking about records that you've done with the band since you've been in the band, there was a song you and I were talking about that that you really are proud of, right? That's one of your more...
You asked me about that, and I think this is the song that I'm proud of, because the band kind of let me let loose a bit.
Yeah.
You know, do a bit more, do like Keith Moon, and, you know, do a bunch of fills during the verse, kind of play over the vocals, and which is usually frowned upon. But this is one of those songs that the producer, Julian Raymond, and the band kind of just wanted the drums to be a bit more bombastic and kind of over the top. And
yeah,
kind of did my thing on it, which was cool.
It's a great tune. It's called You Got It Going On, for all you folks watching and listening. And it's, I'm sure all the Cheap Trick fans know this song really well. It's from the We're All Right album. And what year did this come out, Dax? Was it?
Oh, geez. With the pandemic, I forget. Or something. Probably 18 or 19, I would think.
Ah, okay.
17, 18, 19.
Prior to. Okay, gotcha. All right. Well, I'm going to play it and give a listen, everybody. You Got It Going On. The great Dax Nielsen on drums.
You got the look and you got the life.
Man, I guarantee everybody that just heard that song, you're going to be humming that song for the rest of the day, which is what I did yesterday. Yeah. It's freaking awesome, man. And your playing is lights out.
Thanks. That was just a fun one to fill in all the gaps, you know. I think that's why they call it drum fills, I suppose. it was cool. They kind of let me go a little crazy. You know, I'm not going all over the place, but where there was a spot, they told me to put something there. So that was fun.
Yeah. That's the great thing. I mean, the song still grooves like crazy, like all throughout. And then you take all those spots, like you say, and you just color them with these great fills. Really tasty, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, man, it's awesome. And it sounds like it was recorded pretty, like, you weren't having to play to a click track or anything to just, sounds like you were pretty loose and free to just kind of do your thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think for the most part, we try to get a take as a band in the studio.
Yeah.
There's a handful of songs over the last four albums that Robin's scratch vocal became the album take, you know, kind of thing. So,
wow.
You know, get in there, do your job, be prepared. And hopefully, you know, if you screw up, everybody but the drummer can screw up because you have to get that drum take.
Right. But, exactly.
You know, hopefully you don't. Hopefully that's the take. And there's a lot of songs that we've done that, it's the band playing live, which is the way it used to be, you know?
I know. And I have to think I think of you guys as a band like that still records that way, like the way bands used to be, which is like everybody in the room playing. And you mentioned Robin, and I should have mentioned Robin too, because man, talk about one of the all time great singers, you know, and there's a song right there that you said, like just a couple of years old, still bringing it with like that Robin Zander, you know, like, yeah. Oomph.
I mean, he was probably 65 when he recorded that song. You know, like, when you think of other 65-year-olds, that's retirement age. You know, like, you're getting kind of older and you're done working. He's out there kicking ass, you know? It's cool.
Yeah, yeah. And your dad, too, kicking ass. Yeah,
I think them just keeping moving all the time. I hate to say this, but every old person I talk to, the key to life is to keep moving. You know, when you see somebody sit still, that's when they get old. So I think with the band, I just keep touring, keep playing. If we're not on tour, we're probably in the studio or we're doing something else. You know, when I'm home, I've got a home studio. I try to get as much work out of here as I can because I go crazy. You know, there's only so many dishes to put away and only so many beds to make. And then you go, okay, what do I do now? sit around, watch TV? Nope.
No, you're not a watch TV guy. I can tell that. No,
I've explained that already.
Oh man! So and before I forget to ask you, so that tune, obviously playing Ludwig drums and
always and forever.
Yep. And what was the snare? The snare sounded awesome.
That one I don't recall. I mean, we were at Blackbird Studios in Nashville.
All right.
I'm sure, which they've got a collection there of everything, but.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you. I always think that afterwards. I should have written down like what my snare was, what cymbals I played on this track or whatever. Only I would care, really. Maybe like there's a few fans out there that would want that information, but I don't know. It was most likely a Ludwig and it was most likely I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. No,
it could have been wood, it could have been metal. I have no idea. Yeah. But it sounds good.
It sounds great. And I always get this wrong too, Dax, but like in my mind, as I'm listening, I'm thinking it sounds like a Black Beauty or maybe even just a basic Superphonic or it sounded like a metal drum for me, but it could very easily have been a wood drum and you know, why would I think that? I don't know, but
when I do sessions, I don't specifically say they have to be Ludwigs because there's always, you know, there might be a house kit that is pieced. It could be four different drum companies, but this floor tom sounds great and that. And so you listen to it and go, oh, it sounds good, you know? So, but live and preferably in the studio, everything is Ludwig for me and always has been.
Right. Yep. That's great. And do you remember, did the drums come from Drum Paradise from Harry McCarthy there?
I'm sure. Yep. It was Harry. It was my own kit. I know that for a fact. Harry came out one day and, on that session, at least, you know, probably at the very beginning, the first day to deliver everything and just say hello and what a sweet guy he is.
Sure is. Yeah. Man. And you know, he probably would remember. He'd probably go,
he would know.
You know, he's like, he would know. Yeah. Hey, do you know Philip Rhodes? who was the original drummer for the Gin Blossoms.
I don't know him personally, no.
He's on right now, and he says hello to you.
Or do and, I? I'm sorry, Philip. I don't think we've met, but hello, my friend.
Yeah, and he lives in he used to live in Phoenix, which is
right. Yeah, yeah. We need to meet up. Let's go grab lunch.
I'll connect you guys
about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, and I have one of his platinum records on my wall behind me somewhere. I don't know if you can see it, Philip. I think it's right. Oops, I think it's right there.
I can't see the chat on here, but I believe Philip, my neighbor Mike Trella. You guys used to play in his backyard, like in his outside of his pool, play like until the cops came. He said, he says the Gin Blossoms came and jammed all the time. He's probably lying.
Until the cops came. No, that just has such a funny sound to it, you know. Oh, hilarious. But man, I just want to say that was a great tune, and I know you've done some writing with the band as well, right? You've contributed to some of the songwriting.
To be included with, you know, co-writing a lot of the stuff in the last couple albums.
That's great.
I've never been a lyricist, but I write a ton of music, you know, for my own sake, you know, I've got tons of stuff. And it always turns out to be like singer-songwriter, like jazzy, not jazz, but like acoustic guitar, piano stuff that, you know, I can never write rock and roll until I get in the right scenario, like with Cheap Trick. And then, okay, I got to come up with some rock parts, you know?
Yeah.
And when my solo album comes out, it's going to be, it comes with a box of Kleenex and
that's all right. It'll sell.
Sad
man.
Bastard music.
Yeah. So when you have written though with the band, is it like in the room with everybody? Is it like that sort of a thing? Or do you come with an idea? You go, okay, I got this.
50-50. Yeah. Like currently around this time, we're all writing and just coming up with. Maybe you write a full song, but maybe the verse is the only good, really good part. And then somebody else has a chorus that they've written and you kind of put it all together individually, but together, you know, eventually.
Yeah. But yeah. A true.
Usually when you book a studio, these days, you don't have a month to like sit around and write. So pretty much everything's formulated by the time you get in there to really, okay, we have 5 days to record 14 songs completely, you know, because we have 7 gigs next week. So we got to get out of here kind of thing, you know?
And I mean, you're probably exaggerating a little bit, but probably not a lot, right? I mean, but you work on those kinds of timetables, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Right? I think everybody, you come prepared. And I think, and, you know, it's, we're not, none of us are, you know, professional studio musicians necessarily, but it's that kind of the same mentality. You come and, here's the time we have available and learn your part.
Yeah. Yep.
Make it up on the spot if you need to, but you know, just here's how the song goes. Come up with your parts at home. And then we're going to come in. Sometimes we'll like sound check new songs, but rarely. It's mostly like we all do our homework at home and there's enough emails and all that stuff going back and forth to work on a song over a few months kind of thing.
I wondered that makes sense that, yeah, well, like you mentioned earlier, cloud sharing, and like you can send each other music and you can come to the studio pretty much knowing the tunes and everybody, you do your homework, like you say, and you nail it.
That's the way to be, man.
That's the way to be. That's great. Well, man, I so appreciate you taking time today to talk with me, Dax, and I know I'll think of a million more things I want to talk to you about, so maybe we can do another one of these down the road and...
I'm available anytime, my friend.
All right.
No, it's just so we saw each other, kind of re-met at PASIC a couple weeks ago. And it was like, we talked about doing this and you asked me if I would. And I said, of course. And it wasn't even 2 weeks before it happened. So
well,
thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure.
If you need me to, I'm an open, sometimes I never shut up.
No, I don't think so, man.
We can talk about food. We can talk about, anyways, that's the next one. But come on,
that'll
my
be the
food
next
podcast.
One. But I so, you know, I not that I was hesitant to even ask you, but I, you know, it's like in the midst of all that we were doing, that you were doing, and we, you know, in the mix of the PASIC event, I didn't want to like go, hey, can I? But I was so glad you were so receptive to the idea, and I didn't want to wait too long. So
I mean, you bought me lunch, so what am I supposed to do?
It works every time. Oh man, I got to say though, it was when you mentioned Matt Cameron. I don't think he's watching this right now, but in case he is, talk about like an unbelievable human. He's like you. He's just such a great, humble, good human. You know,
and he has no reason to be. He's been in more famous bands than anybody else in history, basically. He exercises. He stays in shape. He is a family man. And then he's a bad MF-er on the drums. Just like, he's got his own style. Like, you know, like, he just plays differently. His fill choices and the way he can play in different time signatures and make it just flawlessly. Like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Where I'm 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. Yeah. He's like, I don't know. I just kind of play I know the song. But yeah. What a great guy. And
yeah.
I was in Seattle a couple months ago. And I went and saw him in Ballard, which is like the small town above Seattle. And it was just him on guitar with his kids in the and like a couple other side musicians. But he was playing guitar and his kids were in the band.
Man.
So when he's not playing sold out football stadiums, you know, he's playing for 300 people or less, 150 people in some club in Seattle on his spare time.
That's, with his kids, too. What's better than that, you know?
No, and they're all tall. God damn it. Sorry. Didn't take the Lord's name in vain.
Yeah, Chris Lord, I know. But you're right. I mean, I've known that guy 30-something years, and he's exactly the same. I mean, he hasn't gained an ounce. He's tall and lean and, you know, bastard and plays his butt off.
Yeah. Right. No, he's great. And it's one of those, like I was talking earlier about being led into these circles now by being in Cheap Trick for so long that, like, I text Matt Cameron occasionally, you know, we both chat and whatnot. And it's like, how is this happening? You know, because when I was 14, I mean, he was already successful by the time I was, you know, I assume he's probably late 50s at this point.
I think so. He might even be 60.
Like close to 60.
I think he might be.
I'm 43. Like... So, I mean, he was already like full on when I was 12, 13 years old, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're such a humble guy. You're in that circle. You know what I mean? You're one of the guys, no doubt.
I pinch myself every day when I get that text from somebody like, holy shit. Actually, I just got asked to play with Eddie Vedder next week and I can't, or not next week, in February. And I can't do it.
Oh, bummer.
Chris Chelios from the Chicago Blackhawks is getting inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame. And I've played with Eddie Vedder a couple times for the Chicago Cubs. Theo Epstein is the guy that took the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah, sure.
I know. He was the whatever you call it, general manager.
The GM, yep.
GM.
And for the Cubs too, yeah.
They have a thing called the Hot Stove Cool Music. And it's just a bunch of music events to raise money for charities. And I got to play with Ed a couple times. And it was like, that was crazy. And
that's pretty wild, yeah.
So I'm like, I'm hanging out with the Pearl Jam guys 35 years after I just like had them on my wall. It's pretty, pretty cool.
I mean, yeah, cause you're right in that age of that, you know, like when they hit, you know, you were like right in that sweet spot of being like, you know,
it was a good time when I was like 12, it was like Metallica's Black Album, Pearl Jam's first album, Soundgarden, all that stuff was just coming out. That is like, became, you know, Blood Sugar Sex Magik by the Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
Came out on my birthday in like 90. I think, you know, that was a good time to be a kid.
It was. No.
And drums in your basement.
Yeah. It really was a great time. It was a great time for music. Yeah. Nirvana's record had come out like about a year or so before. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was like things were changing like crazy in the business, but there was all this, like this influx of all this great new music. Wow.
It's wild.
Yeah. And good for you for, you know, like you absorbed it and kind of came out with your own thing, you know?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just love it. I mean, same as you. Here's my drums behind me. There's your drums behind you.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like after we get off this, I'll probably play for a bit. Just
good.
You know, just, then I'll go tinker around the guitar and then go pick up my kids from school and, you know, got to keep your day busy. Got to keep moving kids.
Well, I thank you so much for doing this today, Dax, and joining me. Yeah.
And thanks for everybody that tuned in. I appreciate everybody watching.
thanks everybody for watching, all the folks, all the Cheap Trick fans and all the rest of the fans, and Philip Rhodes.
Philip.
Gin Blossoms. Yeah.
A man.
Yeah.
Let's get great together. Guy.
Yeah. I'll connect you guys. And my
Sounds
buddy Dan,
good.
There's a great vintage drum guy in also named Dan Peterson right there in Phoenix too. I can connect you with him as well. I got this badass Gretsch kit, 1970 Ooh. Chrome
Oof.
Gretsch kit from him.
Am I mistaken, or is that other kit, is that set up left-handed, the one on your right?
That's my main kit. I'm a lefty drummer.
You're lefty, so, okay.
Yeah, that's it's
are you,
one
are
of
you
the,
teaching down there? Is that what's going on?
No. I'm just getting inspired.
You're doing like the Beatles. Paul McCartney's neck goes that way and George's or John's goes that way.
Exactly, yeah.
It's that feng shui, drum shui.
Yeah, but
thanks for having me, John.
My pleasure, Dax. You're an inspiration and really a pleasure, and it's a pleasure to call you my friend, so thank you.
Likewise.
All right, hang tight if you would for 1 second. I'll end the stream and we'll say goodbye to everybody. Thanks for watching, everybody. Big hand for Dax Nielsen, and thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.
All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live From My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right. Again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again real soon. See ya.